Welcome to Huntsman Knows How. I'm Kevin Gunderson, Vice President of Communications and Government Affairs, and I'm pleased to be joined today by Tony Hankins, our President of Huntsman Polyurethanes. I've invited Tony here today to talk about his career at Huntsman, life as a global business leader in the chemical industry, and leadership lessons learned along the way. Tony, welcome to the Huntsman Knows How podcast.
Kevin, good morning. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Tony, I want to start at number 10 Downing Street in London 2 weeks ago, where a son of Manchester found himself among the spirit of Sir Winston Churchill. Tell us about that.
Kevin, it was truly an amazing experience. Marta Zoldatz and I were in London for a couple of days to meet with policymakers, politicians, to talk about climate change, energy policy, net zero. We visited the House of Commons, the House of Lords. I was really surprised when we were invited to number 10 Downing Street to meet with a senior advisor to the Prime Minister. And I fully expected that we would be going in through the back door. We call in England the tradesman's entrance. But no, we were invited through the front door, the big black door, and it was just an amazing experience. It's a smaller house than you expect, and it's on three different floors. And as you climb up to the conference room there, you climb up the staircase, and all the portraits and all of the pictures of all prime ministers in the UK are hanging on the wall, starting in 1721 with Sir Robert Walpole, all the way down to Rishi Sunak today. But my hero was there, Sir Winston Churchill. Halfway up the stairs, Sir Winston was there beaming down on us. And my only really sadness of the whole thing was we had to leave our bags and our phones and our cameras as security, so I couldn't have a picture taken next to Sir Winston, but it was just an amazing experience.
I want to go back to the early 1960s when two things happened in England. The first was in Liverpool when four young boys named John, Paul, Ringo, and George started a band. And we're not going to get into exact years, but somewhere in that time frame, about an hour to the east in Manchester, Anthony Hankins was born. Tell us about Tony Hankins.
Well, Kevin, I was born in Manchester. Very proud to be born in Manchester. We don't talk about Liverpool. Yeah, I grew up in a large family. I have four siblings, three brothers and a sister. My father was an electrical engineer. My mother was a school teacher. We had a great time as a family. Very close. You know, both my parents were a very significant influence on my life. They taught me the value of hard work, the value of loyalty, and the value of a close family. And those values have never left me, and I'd be part of Huntsman. That's one of the reasons I feel so at home working for Huntsman Corporation.
So after growing up in Manchester, you went to university and majored in chemistry.
That's right.
What made you choose chemistry as a field?
Oh, I always loved chemistry, even as a young child. I remember my best friend, we were 7 or 8 at the time, and he managed to get his hands on a chemistry set, and we did some experiments in his mother's kitchen. And I'll never forget, we mixed a chemical called potassium permanganate, which is a very strong dye, and we managed to get it all over the kitchen. We managed to dye the worktops and the sink, this deep purple color. And I learned very early on the hazards associated with chemicals in the wrong hands. So I had quite an early lesson in EH&S and the importance of product stewardship. But I just fell in love with chemistry. It was, to be honest, probably the only thing at school I was any good at. I certainly wasn't very good at English, which was a big embarrassment to my mother because she was an English teacher. But I just fell in love with chemistry. My grandfather had worked for ICI for almost 30 years, and he thought ICI was just the greatest company in the world. And he ended up getting me a job at summers and in the winter vacations, and it just became kind of inevitable I go into the chemical industry.
Tell us about ICI back then, because I think it plays a large part in your life and certainly the Huntsman story, but what is ICI? What was ICI?
Well, ICI was one of the great British institutions at the time, Imperial Chemical Industries. It had a history going back over 100 years, and it was one of the greatest employers in the UK. It doesn't exist today, which is very sad. It was just a great employer. ICI educated me. They paid for my education. They taught me leadership, process, manufacturing. It was just a great foundation in which to grow up. With me personally, they took enormous risks in terms of my career development.
One of the biggest risks that I know they took was in the early 1990s as China was beginning to open up and Western companies were moving in there. And you were selected / volunteered to go to China, which today, 10 years ago, is a much easier move than it was in the early 90s. Tell us about your whole China journey, how you ended up there, and what that experience was like.
Yeah, I think it's a great example of serendipity, really, about being in the right place at the right time. And ICI had operated in China for over 100 years. And in 1949, like most Western companies were asked to leave China. And ICI had been trying to sell into China since then via Hong Kong and Taiwan. And in 1993, ICI made a very conscious decision to go back into China, to build a business there and to re-enter China following Deng Xiaoping's reforms of the economy. You know, ICI were looking for someone to go and pioneer that startup. I wasn't the first they asked. I think I was the first that said yes.
And why did people say no?
Oh, I think it was then a country that was still developing. And when I went to China in 1992, there were, in Shanghai, there were 20 million people and probably 20 million bicycles and hardly any vehicles at all. I mean, it's hard to recognize a Shanghai today from the Shanghai that we moved to. And I went out for a look-see visit, and, you know, I was quite shocked, really, by how on earth could we start a business here? It was just so different from Europe, from the UK that I'd grown up in. Didn't speak the language, didn't understand the culture, we had nothing there. And I came back and said, you know, to ICI, I think it's probably a step too far. And they said, no, try again. Take your wife. Take your wife for a look-see visit. I took my wife, Jo, out. And I'm very, very, very fortunate in that she's very adventurous. And she's a linguist. And she's always wanted to learn Mandarin. Anyway, we went and had a look-see. And I think she was as, you know, surprised as I was about the challenge that we'd face in China in those days. And we had to fly to Singapore to meet with the CEO of ICI. We had to make a decision on whether we go or not. She said some of the wisest words I think that she's ever said. Let's put it this way. She had a very good career at the time. She was a marketing director for a very well-known foods company. Better career prospects than I had. She had a company car. I didn't have a company car. And she said, look, if we go to China, I'm going to have to give up my career. And the odds on, you won't succeed. I mean, you've never done this before. You've never built a business from scratch. And we'll probably come back in a year from now, having failed with our tail between our legs and have to start all over again. We'll have to leave everything behind. You know, we just bought a wonderful house. And, you know, ICI at the time said, just take two suitcases in case we need to leave quickly. And then she said, but if we don't go and the Chinese economy takes off and things develop, we will never forgive ourselves for not having the opportunity to go in right at the beginning. And right there and then, we just decided we'd do it. And that's what we did in early 1994. We both packed two suitcases and flew to China, and we were there for almost 5 years, building the business.
So you arrived there, 1994, and there's no business there, right? You're starting from a clean slate. What do you do?
Well, we had a little bit of business because we were selling from Hong Kong and Taiwan. So there was like a foundation.
But on the ground, no business.
No, there was nothing. We had nothing. And the first thing we did was to rent a warehouse and build a very, very basic technical center. We could see the opportunity was refrigerators and footwear. And we got a molding machine to do some trials to demonstrate polyurethane's capability. And I recruited very early on, some great people, people who were bilingual, people who had technical backgrounds, Chinese people. And slowly but surely, we started to build the business. And then we built a systems house in Minhang, in a development zone. It took 3.5 years to build that. In the West, we could have built it in 15 months. It took 3.5 years to build it in China. And I'm very indebted to a number of Taiwanese colleagues who came over and helped me do that, helped build it, provide the engineering expertise, and get the business going. And slowly, we started to recruit and to build. It was great. I mean, how many opportunities do you get in your career to build a business from absolutely nothing?
In a market that big?
Yeah, it was an enormous education.
What did you learn about yourself? What did you learn about business, new markets, people? Quite a cultural change from Europe to go to China at that time.
Yeah, I think very similar around the world. I mean, they all wanted to improve their quality of life. They all want a better life for their children. And the Chinese people are very entrepreneurial. They're very business focused. You know, commerce itself was invented in China thousands of years ago. Very capable business people and very hardworking. And I loved it. The energy was tremendous. And it was all about the future, not about the past. In the office, I put like a big gong. And every time we got a sale, you could go up and hit the gong. And that was a big moment when we started to get sales and build a business. We started with refrigerators, say, footwear, and then it grew from there. And then in the end, we negotiated a license for the first MDI plant. We were the first to build an MDI plant in China. And in those days, we had, it's hard to believe it now, but we had over 60% market share in those early days. Wow, I dream of that today.
So you're there for 4, 5, 6 years. And one day you wake up and ICI has been acquired. the ICI polyurethanes division has been acquired by a company named Huntsman. Tell us about that.
Well, ICI had been going through a tough time. And the chief executive who'd come in had made a number of acquisitions from Unilever and, you know, had decided which parts of the business were core and which weren't. And it was clear that parts of ICI were going to get sold off. Petrochemicals, pigments business, and polyurethanes. And John Huntsman bought the business. You know, at the time, it was a shock, I guess, for everybody that this company that had been around for 100 years was being broken up and sold off. But for polyurethanes, it was a great move because we moved from a company that had lost its interest and its commitment to polyurethane. John Huntsman used to call it the crown jewel, polyurethanes. It was the crown jewel in the portfolio. And that was a wonderful thing to be.
So the first time you met John, he comes to China. Tell us about that experience.
Yes, what was amazing was within, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks of the acquisition, John called up and said, can I come out for 2 weeks? And will you take me to meet our customers, our employees, visit our sites? I'd worked for ICI at that point for over 20 years, and that had never happened before. We'd never had a senior leader come out for 2 weeks who genuinely wanted to meet our associates and our customers. And it was just so different. And John was so different. Very, very people-oriented. And ICI were not that. You know, the ICI, it was about the process, the manufacturing, and the system. And with Huntsman, it was about the people. It was about human chemistry, not organic chemistry. And that was the big difference that I noticed on day one, traveling around Asia with John.
Tony, I was in China in January at our campus in Shanghai, and I looked around and just marveled at the entire team there, the people, the operation. And I remember thinking about you walking around. You helped build that with a lot of help, with a lot of colleagues and associates. You got there 30 years ago, and you go there today, and it's a huge business with amazing people. What do you feel when you go there and see that and look back over that arc of 30 years? Because to me, that's quite a legacy.
Well, I feel a combination of, I feel at home. I feel very at home in China. And I guess that's not a common thing to say for a Westerner. I still have a lot of friends in China. And, you know, when I get off the plane in Shanghai, I feel I'm at home again. I feel intense pride for what everybody's achieved in that team. And when we built the systems house, Minhang was really empty. You know, I looked out of my office window in the systems house, and where the campus is today was pretty much swampland. I remember reading about campuses around the world, and I thought, wouldn't it be great if we built a Huntsman campus in China where we could come together as a team? Family's a big part of the Chinese culture. Teamwork's a big part of the Chinese culture. And it's just amazing to see a dream come true. Very proud of the campus. And it's in John Huntsman's favorite color, the red color of Huntsman.
Yeah.
You'll probably notice as you go around China, we every building that we constructed was that red color. And it's also the color of my favorite football team, Manchester United. And it's also a very lucky color in China. It means prosperity and good luck. So it's a win-win-win. And that's why if you go to China, most of our buildings are in the Huntsman red.
So this is an excellent segue into Tony Hankins, the person. You beat me to the punch by bringing up Manchester United, which I know is near and dear to your heart. I had a question here to ask you about Alex Ferguson, because I know he's one of your heroes, but since you brought up Man U, what have you learned from Man U's success over the last 25 years? Maybe not so much recently, but in the 90s and 2000s. And what leadership lessons have you taken from Sir Alex into business?
I'll probably have to go back a bit, Kevin, because the history of Manchester United for me is my father. And he was a passionate Manchester United supporter. I think he went to almost every home game for almost 40 years. And one of my very, very first memories were back in May of 1968 when Manchester United won the European Cup for the first time. And I watched it on a black and white TV with my father and my siblings. I've never seen my father so excited when they beat a Portuguese club called Benfica 4-1. And I was a small boy, and I remember looking up to my father and saying, Dad, when I grow up, I'm going to go and take you to see Manchester United win the European Cup live. And it was a big part of my upbringing. He took me to my first game when I was 4 or 5 years old. And almost every other Saturday, he and I would go to Old Trafford when I was growing up in Manchester. That was part of my relationship with my father, which is very close. And, you know, wherever I was in the world, on a Saturday or a Sunday, I'd phone him up and we'd spend an hour on the phone together. And 59 minutes of that would be about Manchester United. At the end, he'd say, and how are you doing? So yes, fast forward, and under Sir Alex Ferguson, Manchester United, you know, achieved probably the greatest period in their history. He was a wonderful leader, man-manager, ability to get the best out of individuals, but at the same time, build a team. I think the highlight of that for me was in 1999, when I had to wait 31 years to deliver on my promise to my father, when United got to the European Cup final against Bayern Munich and Barcelona, and I managed to get two tickets and take my father to see that game, which United won in almost the last minute of the game. It was a great night. It's just a big part of my upbringing.
Tony, as you look back over that 30 years in China and that pride you feel about the business today and feeling so at home, as you look at geopolitical events today, what are your thoughts?
Kevin, I think it's a really difficult question because I try and look through all that. You know, my job isn't to figure out the politics and the relationship at the senior levels between the governments of China and the U.S. I just see people in the U.S. and people in China trying to do better for themselves, make a better life, move the business forward. We have common goals, common direction, and I just look through all that. It's, you know, I know it's simplistic to say it, but it is a concern. The people in China are just like you and me. They have similar ideals and similar dreams for their children, their families, and get on with it.
You talked about your dad in Old Trafford. What did you learn from him?
Loyalty, passion, excitement, commitment. He just, difficult to describe, but he just really, really came alive on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
The one thing I did learn from Sir Alex was what he did not do well, and that was succession planning. And the last 10 or 11 years since he retired have been dismal times for Manchester United. Mm. And a lot of that is because he left a leadership vacuum. And it surprises me today when I look at football teams in general that they don't have good succession planning. They hire and they fire. And, you know, the average length of a premiership manager is maybe 12 months. I don't know. It amazes me. And it's had a catastrophic effect on the team.
I'm going to ask a couple questions about Tony Hankins, the man, kind of a rapid fire. And we're going to maybe do 30-second answers. What do you regret in life, and what do you wish you did differently?
Kevin, I can honestly say I don't regret anything, and I wouldn't do anything differently. I've had an amazingly lucky life, and I think the thing I've learned in that is the most difficult decisions are the ones you have to make when something inside you say, don't do it, and you must do it, because those are the moments that drive the greatest change. The most important career decision I ever made was moving to China, no question. And it was very difficult, because it meant giving so much up, but we got so much back in return. Back in the early 90s, my wife and I traveled length and breadth of China. We saw things that we'll never see again. You know, this was before China took off, before it developed. It was an amazing time to see that country develop.
Tony, what brought you from China to the U.S.?
Oh, John Huntsman. Huntsman were expanding and building, and, you know, we relocated here in 2001. And it was interesting. My father loved America. He'd been here on a business trip once when he was younger, and he used to say, son, go west, the future's west, go west. And you never listened to your father, so I went east and then eventually came west. And I think it's probably a good way to do it, because I've come to the United States first, I probably never would have left. So to work my way around the world, we've lived and worked in 9 different countries, to come to the United States was great. I love living here, I love working here. It's a very dynamic culture, very business-oriented culture. It's all about the future. And our daughter was born here, so she's a true American, which we're very proud of.
What did John Huntsman teach you about children, family?
He certainly had a lot of experience with family. When we did the IPO in 2005, our daughter had just been born. She was about 3 months old. And I remember going traveling around the world with John as we were marketing the company for the IPO. And he wrote down a piece of paper. He said, Tony said, the secret from a father to a daughter are the 3 A's. And he wrote it down on a piece of paper, A-A-A. What are the 3 A's? And I said, John, I haven't a clue. Rebecca's 3 months old, and I have no idea. I've really given a lot of thought. He said, well, the first A, he said, is affection. Affection is a very, very important A for a father-daughter relationship. Second A is attention. Got to give your little girl a lot of attention. They know when you're not and when you're zoned out. And he used to say, when I get home, when you get home on a Friday evening, you know, your job title is not president, it's daddy. And get yourself into the mindset of a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old. But he said the most important A is the A for adventure, and the father has got to give his daughters adventures. And I took that to heart, and every year I take Rebecca away and we have an adventure somewhere, really great adventures. You know, these are memories I hope that she will always remember. That time is very special between a father and a daughter. He taught me to become a better father, a better husband, and just a better leader. I mean, he was a great mentor for me personally.
What has been your best adventure?
Oh, without doubt, we went on an adventure, on an expedition to the Antarctic about 5 years ago, to the South Pole. and it was something my wife always wanted to do. I was very lucky. I persuaded Peter to give me almost 4 weeks off for Christmas, and we went on this expedition down to the Antarctic, the coldest, the driest, the windiest, the most inhospitable place on the planet. And we spent almost 3 weeks down there, and it was an amazing experience.
What did you learn?
That even in the most terrible climates, life still thrives. You know, whether it be penguins, whether it be seals, whether it be plants. It was amazing that life gets a foothold, even the most inhospitable place in the world. And it really brought us together as a family. We were on an icebreaker in a very small cabin, the three of us. You could touch all four walls in that cabin. It certainly wasn't a romantic holiday. And we just had a great time. It was a heck of an adventure.
What was your hardest day at work?
Oh, I had some tough times in China, I think. I think probably there were days in China where I really wondered whether we could succeed, whether we could make it through. And my wife and I got very ill at one point. We got hepatitis, and we had to go back to the UK for some medical checks. I remember the ICI doctor saying to me, Mr. Hankins, if I were you, I'd strongly suggest giving up smoking. And I hadn't smoked in my life. And it was the pollution at the time in China. And we had some tough times there. And ICI were great. The CEO came out, and I think he was fairly surprised by our physical appearance. And he insisted that every month we go to Hong Kong for a long weekend for R&R to rest and recover. And that was terrific. But I think, some of the hardest days of my career were in China, when you had to dig deep to really believe you could succeed. You know, at the time, there were only, I think, 1,000 expatriates in the whole of China.
1,000. Wow.
And very limited places that we could live. You know, accommodation was not great. So, you had to dig deep.
You've been running a global business for 20 years. Receive a lot of information, both internally, externally. How have you learned to figure out what matters and to make decisions based on good information, especially in today's world where it just comes real time from everywhere?
You know, one of the most important aspects of that is curiosity. I think to be a leader today, you have to be very curious. Therefore, you have to read a lot. And I try and read a lot to learn what's going on in the world, what's going on in the business areas that we sell into. And it's then a matter of distilling out the critical information and all that stuff that you read. My mother, being an English teacher, was very curious when we were kids and growing up. She'd never say what, she'd always say, but why? I remember that was a favorite saying, but why? And she is just an amazing woman when I look back at what she did. She's 94 years old now and still traveling the world on her own. And when my father passed away 14 years ago, I sat my mum down. She took it very badly at the time. And I made her watch a movie. It's called The Bucket List with Morgan Freeman and
Jack Nicholson.
Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right, Jack Nicholson. And I made her write down the 10 things that she was going to do on the bucket list, that she was going to do before she passed on. And number one on the list was to go skiing with her granddaughter. And we're very fortunate. We have a home out in the mountains in Colorado. So we flew my mum out, and she was 84, and we got on a pair of skis, and she skied partway down the mountain with my daughter, who's a great skier. We couldn't get insurance for her, obviously, so my wife and I were terrified. And we had to then come down the lift the other way. Normally, you go up a ski lift. We had to take my mum down when she'd done a bit of skiing. And when she got off that lift, she was 10 years younger. And it's amazing. As we all get older, she seems to get younger. The three things I've learned watching her live to a very long life, the three things are mental, physical, and social. She's mentally very active, physically very active. And social's been tough because, you know, most of her friends have passed away when you get to 94. So she loves to travel. She loves to go on cruises to meet new people. And she's just an amazing inspiration that somebody of that age can still travel the world. She Ubers to the airport. She flies out of Manchester Airport all over the world. And my brothers and I are forever worrying where she is and trying to track her down.
So never stop living. It sounds like your mom.
Yeah, she reinvented herself. It's remarkable to see it.
You've been in the polyurethanes industry your entire career, and I've heard you say that polyurethanes and MDI are the polymer of prosperity. And when I was new to the company and new to the industry, that resonated with me when communicating about polyurethanes, because as countries and societies grow, they want washing machines and dishwashers, and they buy nicer cars with nicer seats. Talk about the industry as you've lived it, but also talk about the future of the industry as you see it.
Kevin, it's an amazing industry. It's over 60 years old. you know, it continues to grow. There are very few products in the world that, after 60 years, are still growing, are still thriving, whose best days are still in the future. And it's got amazing functionality. I mean, it grows because the world needs it, but it also substitutes other materials. So it's got two growth drivers here. The growth of population, the growth of consumer trends, but also it's replacing other materials. It's a great insulant. It's a great shock absorber. It's a great comfort foam for mattresses, for seating. But its primary, I think, unique advantage is insulation. And it has a huge role to play here in achieving net zero targets, improving energy efficiency of buildings. And it continues to grow very significantly. It grows at multiples of GDP in many countries. And it's always inside. It's a product that provides immense functionality, but you never see it. It's Huntsman inside, unique. And I find it very exciting that, you know, I'm working in an industry where the best days are still ahead of it, not behind it. And that's not true of all chemicals.
When you look around the world and you think about the fact that it is this polymer of prosperity, there's still many countries and continents that have huge runway to grow, and polyurethanes will be a part of that. Do you see the industry staying the same and continuing to just grow with GDP, or do you think differentiation, new innovation, more sustainable products will be the future, or do you think it'll be different in Africa versus Europe or China?
There's demographic growth in countries like India and still China and Africa, where PET polyurethanes are still in the relatively early stages of development. And then in Western economies, innovation. You know, I'm very excited about some of the innovative products that our team are developing, that Pavneet Mumik and his team are developing. Very focused on sustainability, on energy conservation. But EVs is a big part of our business now, electric vehicles. And more polyurethane is needed in an EV than in a normal internal combustion engine vehicle. So we're seeing a whole new pathway of growth opening up into EVs and hybrids. And innovation is the key. We continue to develop innovative products which meet new applications, new standards, new step outs in terms of technology. The future is immensely bright. It's a very big part of polyurethanes innovation.
You mentioned earlier that you're immensely curious. Two-part question. What is your favorite book that you've ever read? And what is a recent book that you recommend?
There were three books when I grew up as a teenager which I think had a big influence on me. One was Lord of the Rings by Tolkien. Now, it was a huge book. It was the biggest book I'd ever read. But it opened up my mind to you've probably seen the movies, but the book, it was just fantastical to think a world could exist like that.
I did not think you were going to go fantasy.
Well, there are three books. That was one. The second book was a book called My Family and Other Animals about General Durrell. And this was a family that left England in the war and moved to Corfu and started a new life there. And that opened up my imagination to countries and climates that I'd never thought about. I mean, I love Manchester, but I don't love the weather in Manchester. It was just a very sunny book, and I always then wanted to go and travel to the Mediterranean. It kind of opened up my imagination to what other countries could be like. And then the third book, which we read at school, was A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, a Russian writer. And it was about a day in the life of a prisoner in a gulag in mm-hmm. Russia. And that kind of opened my mind as a 14-year-old to some of the great challenges in the world today and politics and tyranny and so on and so forth. Those three books had a pretty big influence on me as a young man in very different ways.
Recent book?
The Worst Journey in the World, written by an explorer called Asprey Gerard, and he was part of the 1911-1912 race to the South Pole. A British explorer called Captain Scott raced a Norwegian called Roald Amundsen to get to the South Pole. Captain Scott and four of his companions froze to death on the way back. They got to the South Pole, but they'd found they'd lost. Amundsen had beaten them to it and had got home, and they died on the journey back to base camp, five of them. And to me, it was it's a leadership lesson in planning. Amundsen was very, very, very well prepared, had the right equipment, had a clear plan, and executed on it extremely well. Captain Scott, to a certain extent, was a romantic, hadn't really planned a lot of gung-ho about the expedition. I mean, a lot of good planning as well. But having been to the Antarctic, and I can't imagine back in 1911, pulling sledges hundreds of miles, wearing clothing today, which it's unbelievable that you could protect yourself with that kind of clothing and protection and temperatures down to minus 80 degrees. It's been a leadership lesson. It's about the horrors of that journey and how he survived, this explorer, as part of that group survived, yet five of the comrades, including the leader, died and froze to death. And there's a lot in that book about risk and reward as a leader. It's a big book. It's 800 pages. And it also brought back the, you know, the adventure we had to the Antarctic 5 years ago. And I was just in awe of what those men did in those times, you know, to conquer places like the South Pole. It's unbelievable.
When you read books like that, and I know you've probably read many of them, how does it impact your leadership style? And how has your leadership style changed over your career?
Wow, that's an interesting question, Kevin. I think as I've grown older, I'm a lot less hands-on than I used to be. You know, one of the things I had to do in China was do everything at the beginning. And therefore, you become very hands-on as a leader when you're building a business from nothing. And it's very important in the job I do now that, you know, I surround myself with great people and let them get on with it. I've had to learn, you know, not to get involved in the detail, to let great people get on and do what they do best. And risk and reward, that's a big part of what, you know, the good things take care of themselves. As a leader, you need to be very focused on what can go wrong. So yeah, I guess, you know, as I've grown older, I worry a lot about the risk in our business and how we mitigate that.
There are a few people at Huntsman, other than the people whose names are on the door, that have had such an impact as you in the history of our company, which means you know a lot about the culture here. And right now, there's a chemist or a chemical engineer or an electrical engineer who's finishing college, and he or she is looking for a job. And they're in Europe, they're in the US, they're in China, they're in 30 countries around the world where we have operations. Why should they come to Huntsman?
The Huntsman culture is unique. The variety of work that we do, the freedom, I like to think Huntsman give you a big canvas to paint your masterpiece on. Tremendous freedom, tremendous opportunity. 2 days are never the same, 2 hours are never the same. You know, I love coming into work in the morning, not really knowing how the day's going to pan out. I'm very, very fortunate in that one day I can be meeting customers in the United States, and then I fly to China, and then I go to Turkey and come back through South America. I mean, the variety is just immense. And to work for a global enterprise with the values and the culture and the family spirit of Huntsman is very special. And it's very different. You know, I don't see that level of commitment and loyalty at other companies, at our competitors or people we deal with. It's unique. And the values the company has is unique. I remember John Huntsman saying to me, "Tony, you think that the best exercise for the human heart is to go to the gym or to go skiing?" Well, it isn't. The best exercise for the human heart is to reach down and lift somebody else up who is less fortunate than you are. And if you do that two or three times a day, every day, you're going to build a very strong heart. That had a very profound effect on me when John said that. It's something that my wife and I spend a fair amount of time on. It's not something that I thought much about before I came to Huntsman. Now I think a lot about it. We're very lucky, very blessed to have had the upbringing we've had, to have the education we've had. And to give back is something that is great, I think, and that's part of the Huntsman culture.
Tony, thank you for joining me today for another episode of Huntsman Knows How. This was a wonderful discussion. I loved hearing about your life, your journey in China, and your career and what you've learned. I think our listeners are going to find value and inspiration in your story. To our listeners, thank you again for joining us for another episode. If you have any suggestions for topics, ideas for content, give me a call, shoot me an email, send me a text. We'd love to hear your ideas. We'll see you next time.